Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Come to you live today in WILL AM 580, based in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Today, September 26, 2010, is a special day in Media Matters. We have one of our favorite guests of all time returning, one of the most important guests of all time returning. Our guest today, live with us on the telephone from Vermont, will be the junior senator of Vermont, U.S. Senator Bernie Sanders, joining us for the full hour to talk about what's going on in this country today, his assessment of it, and to take your telephone call. Should be a terrific hour. I hope you'll join us. But first, let's go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
And I'm Megan Tatey.
1 year ago this week, Federal Communications Commission Chairman Julius Genachowski delivered his first major speech on net neutrality, warning that if we wait too long to preserve a free and open internet, it will be too late. Since that speech at the Brookings Institution, net neutrality advocates have been waiting for Genachowski to move the issue forward. In an effort to remind the chairman of his previous commitment to net neutrality, Free Press issued a report this week that recalls the chairman's own words on the need to protect the internet.
The rise of serious challenges to the free and open internet puts us at a crossroads. We could see the internet's doors shut to entrepreneurs, the spirit of innovation stifled, a full and free flow of information compromised, or we could take steps to preserve internet openness. Saying nothing and doing nothing would impose its own form of unacceptable cost. And it would be a dangerous retreat from the core principle of openness, the freedom to innovate without permission, that has been a hallmark of the internet since its inception and has made it so stunningly successful as a platform for innovation, opportunity, and prosperity.
As Chairman Genachowski waffles on net neutrality, industry giants like Verizon, AT&T, and Google have moved to fill the void in leadership by offering their versions of what the internet should look like, and net neutrality is not part of their plan. Free Press Research Director Derek Turner is one of the authors of the paper.
The net neutrality debate has been ongoing for many years, and more than enough information exists for the FCC to go ahead and write fair rules of the road. The FCC chairman himself, based on his own statements, knows exactly what these meaningful rules should look like, but so far he hasn't taken the actions needed to achieve his own and President Obama's vision of net neutrality. So it's time for this FCC chairman to stop dithering, and that means him taking the action to restore his agency's own authority to protect internet users and then enacting strong and enforceable net neutrality rules to protect all consumers online.
We're seeing the breaks and cracks emerge, and they threaten to change the internet's fundamental architecture of openness. If we wait too long to preserve a free and open internet, it will be too late.
To read the report, in his own words, Julius Genachowski's vision of real net neutrality, go to freepress.net.
Online local news ventures are cropping up every week around the country, with journalists learning as they go about how to forge a newsroom in the digital age, satisfy the need for local news, and build community trust. Some try and fail, some try and succeed. This week, leading pioneers of online news sites are gathering in Chicago at the Block by Block News Summit to help each other make sense of the excitement and chaos of what can feel like a new media wilderness. Michelle McClellan, a Reynolds Journalism Fellow at the Missouri School of Journalism, is organizing the invitation-only conference along with NYU journalism professor Jay Rosen. She said the event was designed to give busy journalists a chance to connect and collaborate with each other at a time when communities are increasingly looking to online news sites for credible news.
There's been kind of a dominant narrative about, mostly in the eyes, I think, of traditional journalists, that you're either a traditional journalist doing quality work or you're a blogger not doing quality work. You know, even if somehow that situation was prevalent 10 years ago, it isn't now.
McClellan, a seasoned journalist herself, says that online news sites can allow journalists to deliver content that's more relevant to and reflective of local communities.
You know, my big criticism of the world I came from was that we really were detached from our communities, that we saw our role as separate and independent. We felt that we were serving our communities, and I think we were in many ways, but I think we failed to really connect with a lot of community needs. that would have really enriched our coverage and made it more relevant and useful to people.
It's this lost connection that many successful online news sites are cultivating, working alongside communities to create reporting with depth and local consequence. McClellan is hopeful that these types of collaborations will embolden journalists to dig deeper.
My hope is that in this mix of journalists who are now more open, I think, to new practices, because they have to be, and community members who are concerned about news and information in their neighborhoods and in their communities, that in that mix we'll see more experimentation with journalism that really puts community front and center.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today, September 26, 2010, here in WILL AM 580. Our guest today is one of the most prominent politicians in the United States today. And whatever one's political views, anyone who knows our guest or has worked with our guest understands him as a person of great public and personal integrity and considerable intelligence. It's an honor to welcome to our program today the junior senator from Vermont, Bernie Sanders. Bernie, welcome to Media Matters.
Great to be with you, Bob.
And thank you so much for taking time out of your schedule. I know how hard you work. I know the demands on your time. It's a real privilege to have you with us for this next hour.
My pleasure.
Well, let's get right to business, so to speak. Let's get to work, Bernie Sanders. You have been, I think, throughout your career, more concerned with the growth of inequality than any other member of Congress since you joined the House of Representatives in 1991. You've been on this show. You've talked about it. You've written about it. You've proposed legislation on it. It's been, I would say, almost a central obsession of yours throughout your career in Washington, D.C. Where does it stand today?
Well, Bob, thanks for asking that question. And I can tell you that over the years, just very few journalists have bothered to even ask what may be the most important question to ask when we talk about our economy. You know, when we discuss economics, people talk about gross national product. They talk about how much we're growing and GDP and all this stuff. But at the end of the day, what matters is how is the average person doing? And what is going on right now in our society is that the middle class is disappearing, poverty is increasing, and the gap between the very, very rich and everybody else is growing wider. So if you say, how is the economy doing to the average CEO of a large corporation, he or she will tell you it's doing great. And the reason for that is that we have seen the top 1% capture a significantly greater percentage of income in America today than they used to have. So we are in a situation today where the top 1% earns 23% of all income in America. And that is the most significant percentage of income earned by the top 1% since 1928, a year before the Great Depression. The top one-tenth of 1% earns 11% of all income. And this compares to back in the 1970s when the top 1% earns just 8% of all income. And today, on top of all that, top 1% earns more income than the bottom 50%. So to answer your question, Bob, what we have is a situation where the United States today has by far the most unequal distribution of income and wealth of any major country on earth, and that inequality has grown substantially in recent years.
Senator Bernie Sanders, I think the question that comes out immediately then is that on Capitol Hill for the last few weeks, or if not few months, one of the key issues has been debating whether or not to lower taxes on the wealthiest Americans. And it's been an issue that the Republicans are very strongly arguing on behalf of, and the Democrats, many are against it, but it seems that it's not coming to a head soon enough, or it's unclear exactly where this is going to go. Can you give us an update?
Yes.
On the
status
of that?
Yeah, there was a lot of discussion in the Democratic caucus. I'm an independent, and I caucus with the Democrats about when to bring the issue up of whether or not the Bush tax breaks for the top 2% should be extended. Now, if we extend the tax breaks for the top 2%, that is $700 billion in tax break that go to the very wealthiest people in this country. And for millionaires, people who are earning more than $1 million, that averages out to be $100,000 in tax breaks to those people. That seems to me, and I think a majority of the people in the Democratic caucus, to be absolutely absurd. When the wealthy are already doing very well, when income inequality is growing in America, when the middle class is in serious trouble, when we have a $13 trillion national debt, it seems to me to be absurd to be giving $700 billion over a 10-year period to the top 2%. My view, and I'm going to fight for this as hard as I can, is you take half of that $700 billion, use it for deficit reduction, take the other half, use it to rebuild our infrastructure and transform our energy system, and in the process, create millions of good-paying jobs. That makes a lot more sense to me than making just the richest people in this country even richer.
Senator Bernie Sanders, there's been a lot of talk from Republicans that if they do not lower the taxes on the wealthiest Americans in the manner that you oppose, that this would lead to a decline in investment because businesses will be reluctant to invest if they can't keep all the wealthy people can't keep as more of the money that the rather lay people offer, not invest money at all. And oftentimes held up are small businesses. They never talk about the big guys, but rather the ma-and-pa small businesses that employ people. And from your experience, is that an accurate claim being made that this is lowering?
No, this is, Bob, what this is the old trickle-down theory of economics. If you give tax breaks to millionaires and billionaires, they're going to reinvest in America, and they're going to create jobs, and everybody's going to live happily ever after. You know, we tried that during the Bush administration, and we've tried that even before that. It is a theory which doesn't work. Under Bush, where we in fact gave huge tax breaks to the wealthiest people in this country and to corporate America, the end result after 8 years of that policy under Bush is that we lost, L-O-S-T, we lost 600,000 private sector jobs after 8 years. That is one of the most disastrous economic records in American history. Yes, the rich got richer and the middle class disappeared, but we lost 600,000 private sector jobs. The end result after 8 years of Bush is we gained net 1 million jobs, all government jobs, many of them related to the military and to Homeland Security. That policy does not work. It's wrong from a, in my view, a moral perspective. At a time when we have so much income inequality, when we have the highest rate of childhood poverty of any major country on earth, 22% of our kids are living in poverty, and you have the top 1% earning over 23% of all income, the idea of giving tax breaks to those people on top seems to me morally wrong. Second of all, in terms of economics, which is what you are referring to, it makes a lot more sense to develop economic policy which puts money into the hands of ordinary people who are certainly going to go out and spend that money and create more jobs than it is into the hands of the very, very rich, who in many cases are not going to spend that money, in some cases are going to invest that money abroad. So I think the economics of it is we should be investing in tax breaks for the middle class and working families. We should be putting money into rebuilding our infrastructure, transforming our energy system. That is the far superior way to create jobs.
I'm Bob McChesney. You're listening to Media Matters and WILL AM 580. We're coming to you live today, September 26. Our guest, as I hope you've known by now, is U.S. Senator Bernie Sanders, the junior senator from Vermont, who's graciously joining us for the full hour. Our phone lines are open at 333-9455 and our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Senator Sanders, I don't know if you saw or are familiar with a report that was done on Keith Olbermann's program on MSNBC last week where an investigative reporter, a tax reporter, went and looked at the small businesses that were being touted to be the beneficiaries of this tax break for people with incomes over $250,000. And they discovered that actually these were firms that were not small businesses in the sense of the technical thing of having fewer than 500 employees, but they counted as small businesses any company owned by less than 100 people, which meant massive companies like Bechtel qualified by this criteria as a small business, and that the overwhelming majority of the tax benefits from the tax break would go to extraordinarily wealthy people.
Well, Bob, needless to say, I am not shocked by this, because one of the issues that we are dealing with right now is not having an honest debate about political philosophy or about where we should go as a nation. There is an enormous amount of disinformation, outright lies, that are being perpetrated by the right-wing media and some of their spokespeople. So I'm not shocked by what you're telling me that Keith Olbermann talked about. Furthermore, I can tell you that right now we're having a major debate also about the future of the estate tax in America, an estate tax which has been in existence for over 100 years, whose idea was originally developed by Teddy Roosevelt back in 1910. And what Republicans refer to this as the quote-unquote death tax. And the implication of that is that any family in America who loses a loved one who's going to leave them some money will have to pay a tax on it. The truth of the matter is, and the Wall Street Journal editorial page perpetrates this nonsense, Fox television, right-wing radio, the truth of the matter is, absolutely consistent with what you have just suggested, is that the only people who are going to pay a nickel in an estate tax is the top 0.3%, millionaires and billionaires. So what the Republicans consistently do when they talk about taxes is they say, oh, people like Bernie Sanders want to tax the middle class. They want to tax family farmers. They want to tax small business people. And that is untrue. What they are doing is defending their millionaire and their billionaire friends who put up huge amounts of money into the political process, and they are representing those people. And there's a lot of misinformation and disinformation which is going out.
Our guest, Senator Bernie Sanders from Vermont. Let's go to the phone lines now for our first caller. Let's go to line 4, Chicago. You're on the air with Senator Sanders. Line 4, Chicago.
Thank you, Bernie Sanders. I really appreciate your appearance today, as well as on some of the other shows I've heard you, and I really commend you for your crusading efforts. And I'd like to say that it confirms some of the things I've talked about in the past. But a lot of this is a matter of jobs. You know, so much of the jobs have been replaced by automation, assembly line, computer programming, and robots, to the point where the human is almost not a necessity in the productive capacity, and yet productivity is increasing and profits are being made, and the human is almost like a non sequitur as far as being necessary in the productive chain of events. So given the fact that people are hoping for jobs, these automated and technological improvements have almost erased the necessity for a human to be in the situation, and therefore the companies are benefiting with not having to worry about vacations, health benefits, and pensions, and so forth. So the future for actual hands-on human beings is almost like negligible. So as I mentioned that to see what you thought of it.
Well, thank you very much, caller. Bernie?
Well, I think there is no question but that automation has increased productivity. There is no doubt about that. I would not go as far as the caller and suggest that there is almost no place for human beings in the productive economy. One of the areas, when we talk about the economy, that concerns me very much is that for many years now, the Republicans and some Democrats have been pushing the mythology of unfettered free trade. And the argument there has been that if we pass a NAFTA, if we pass a permanent normal trade relations with China, and we lower tariffs in this country, what will happen is workers in the United States will see more jobs being created as we create and produce products here and we sell them all over the world. Well, obviously, that hasn't happened, and nobody should be surprised at that. I was in China a number of years ago, and I went to a Walmart in China. If you walk into a Walmart in China, it looks kind of like a Walmart in the United States. They have all kind of American products. And I asked the guy there who ran the store what percentage of products were actually made in the United States and sent to China. And he said about 1%, which had surprised nobody. So I think when we look about how we rebuild our manufacturing sector, and the caller is right, automation has had its impact, but I think unfettered free trade has also had its impact, and we can deal with that issue. I think the issue here is that we have lost over the last many years millions and millions of good-paying jobs that have gone to China, gone to India, gone to developing countries where workers are paid pennies an hour. I think it is absolutely appropriate that we demand that corporate America that wants to sell us these products, they want us to buy them, should start producing some of them back here in the United States again. So I think working on the issue of trade is very, very important. In terms of productivity, as the caller indicates, and what automation has done, it is fair to demand that the working people of this country benefit from that productivity, and not all of it ends up going into the hands of the people who own these corporations.
Bernie Sanders, it seems that in some European countries that have very high standards of living, higher than the United States at this point, like Germany, they still have a much greater percentage of their workforce doing manufacturing and in union jobs. How do countries like that pull it off?
Well, they did not fall into the trap, in many cases, of unfettered free trade like we did. I voted against NAFTA when I was in the House. I voted against PNTR, free trade with China, because I didn't think take a genius to understand that American workers should not be asked to compete against people abroad who are making 20, 30, 50 cents an hour. I thought that was wrong, and my fears, and the fears of many Americans at that time, Bob, have turned out to be right. What we need is a fair trade policy. A fair trade, not unfettered free trade. Trade is a good thing, but like anything else, it has got to be designed to protect the ordinary people in this country and not just the heads of large corporations. So I think we want to focus on fair trade. I think we want to create jobs by transforming our energy system away from fossil fuel into energy efficiency and sustainable energy. One of the areas that I'm very concerned about, as we talk about wind, solar, it is China that is exploding in those areas, producing a huge amount of solar panels, wind turbines. We should be doing that in this country. I think we should be providing support to small businesses rather than corporate welfare for large corporations. I think if you do some of those things, we can create the kinds of jobs we need in this country.
Senator Bernie Sanders, we are about, a little over five or six weeks out from the midterm elections of 2010, which right now are generally forecast to be going the way of the Republicans and a rejection of the Democratic Party. And I recall shortly after the 2008 election talking with several friends from across the political spectrum, and there was a general consensus that in 2006 and 2008, the American electorate had dramatically rejected the Republican foreign policy, the Republican economic policy. This had been a long time historically since you had a party win two consecutive elections so dramatically at the national level, and that everything was in alignment, really, for the Democrats to sort of have a generation of power if they played their cards right and stick the final stake into the heart of sort of the right-wing politics that had been rejected. And now it looks like that seems like 100 years ago. What happened?
Well, Bob, that's, I think, the $64 question, and that is, the question that we have to try to understand. And I'll give you my opinion. Others may disagree with me. I think you are absolutely right that the average American looked at 8 years of Bush policies and said, the middle class declined substantially. We lost, in terms of median family income, it went down by over $2,000 a family. 8 million Americans slipped out of the middle class and entered poverty. The deficit, when Bush came in, Clinton gave him a significant surplus under Bush. The deficit almost doubled. People lost their pensions. People lost their health care under Bush. And because of the deregulatory attitude of the Bush administration, Wall Street was able to engage in reckless and illegal behavior, which plunged this country into the recession we're in right now. So I think the ordinary person said, look, all of that stuff is going on. We need a new direction. Obama took office after, in my view, running the best campaign, the most the strongly grassroots effort that I've seen in my political life. And I think people were very excited, wanting to move forward in a very aggressive way. In my view, while it is absolutely fair to say that the president and the Democratic leadership have brought forth a number of significant accomplishments. You know, we passed health care reform. 30 million more Americans are going to have access to health insurance. Passed Wall Street reform. There are some very important provisions in that bill. We passed the stimulus package, which is putting more money into rebuilding our infrastructure, our moving us toward energy independence than at any time in the history of the country. But having said all of that, if you ask me, has the president, has the Democratic leadership been as bold as they should have been? Have they really had the courage to stand up to the big money interests like Franklin Delano Roosevelt did in 1933? Roosevelt came in at a time when the economy was in much worse shape than our economy is right now. And what he said is, look, I am going to take on the ruling class of America. They're going to hate me, and I know that. But I'm asking the working class of this country to stand with me as we transform our economy. Has the president taken that posture? He has not taken that posture. And I think while the Democrats have passed some good legislation, and sometimes I think that gets forgotten, they have not been as bold in rallying working people to understand who caused this crisis. You got a bunch of thieves on Wall Street who could care less about ordinary Americans who are engaged in highly illegal and fraudulent activity. None of these guys, or very few of them, are in jail. And while the financial reform bill that we passed does some good things, it did not go anywhere near far enough. For example, I brought forth legislation to put a cap on interest rates so that working Americans don't have to pay 25 or 30% interest rates on their credit cards. We got 30-some-odd votes on the floor of the Senate. The president didn't support it. So in terms of the stimulus package, we have done a lot, but not enough. In terms of health care, yeah, we did something, but we should be passing a Medicare for All single-payer system, taking on the private insurance companies and the drug companies. So, Bob, to answer your question, and I know there are others may disagree with me, the American people are hurting today. If you look at real unemployment, and that is people who not only have no jobs, but are working 20 hours when they want to work 40 hours, people have given up looking for work. We're about 16%. People are scared that their kids will have a lower standard of living than they do. People understand the greed on Wall Street and the contempt that the CEOs of large corporations have for the average American. I think what the strategy, and frankly, that is what I suggested to the president, the strategy should be to say, okay, we're going to take these guys on. We're going to transform our economy. We're going to spend our time rallying the American people around a progressive agenda. We're going to hold rallies where large numbers of people are going to come out and point their finger at those people who refuse to support the needs of working Americans. Has that been the agenda of the Democratic Party and the president? No, it has not been. So I think what happens is the Republicans are saying, look, these guys have been in power for 2 years. They control the White House, the House of Representatives, the Senate. Is your life any better today? And many people are going to say no. Now, that's an unfair statement to make because it's Bush policies that helped cause this crisis. But that's how many people are responding. So I think we need bolder, more aggressive leadership from the White House and from the Democratic leadership. We need to point the finger at where it deserves to be pointed, and that is the big money interests who have done so much harm to this country. And that's kind of the role I'm trying to play, but it's frankly a tough role in the Senate.
Our guest is U.S. Senator Bernie Sanders from Vermont, joining us live on the phone from Vermont today. I'm Bob McChesney. This is Media Matters and WILL AM 580. Our phone lines are open at 333-9455 and our toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. Senator Sanders, you just talked about the role of money in politics. It's a theme that I think, like inequality, has been central to your political career, battling corruption in our governing process. And this year we saw the Supreme Court rule on the Citizens United case, which effectively means corporations can now give unlimited amounts of money to political campaigns from here on out. For listeners who are really unfamiliar with much about politics, except what they might get on a cable newscast or in their local newspaper, could you just give an assessment of what role money plays from your view, sitting on Capitol Hill, in the day-to-day governance of this country, and what Citizens United might mean for the future?
Well, Bob, that is an excellent question on a very, very important issue. Let us be clear that big money plays a huge, huge role on the political process in Washington and probably every state legislature and governor's office in America. I'll give you just a few examples. The reason we are in the midst of the worst economic conditions since the Great Depression, in my view, has everything to do with the deregulation of Wall Street. the doing away with Glass-Steagall, the allowing of large commercial banks to merge with investment banks, to merge with insurance companies, to create a situation where you had too big to fail and they had to be bailed out and all of this stuff. Bob, do you want to guess over a 10-year period when that fight for deregulation was going on, how much money Wall Street and the other financial institutions spent on lobbying and campaign contributions? You probably wouldn't. The answer is $5 billion.
Wow. That's a lot of bread.
And then, after Wall Street, through their greed and recklessness and illegal behavior, plunged us into the recession, you know what these guys did? They spent $300 million last year in lobbying efforts to make sure that Congress did not do the right thing and make the changes that the American people wanted to make. So you ask about the power. That's just Wall Street. You got the oil companies. This year, ExxonMobil, which has been the most profitable corporation in human history, last year they had a bad year. They only made $19 billion in taxes. Do you know how much money they're paying on the $19 billion in profits last year?
$5?
No. After $19 billion in profits last year, they are getting a $156 million tax refund from the IRS. Now, how does that happen? How does the largest and most profitable, one of the largest and most profitable corporations in America, a company that's made more money than any other company, end up not paying any taxes on $19 billion in profits? That's what money does. It creates a tax system. It creates a tax system in which Warren Buffett often points out. Warren Buffett is, I think, the second richest man in America. He points out that his effective, what he really pays, effective tax rate is lower than what policemen and firemen and teachers and nurses pay, because the rich and powerful want to make sure they pay as little in taxes as they possibly can. So you ask me the power of money, it is enormous. Now, as you correctly point out, last year the Supreme Court, by a 5-4 decision, the right-wing Supreme Court, all the Republicans on it, voted to say that large corporations should be treated as human beings. And ExxonMobil and Goldman Sachs' right to contribute as much money into the political process is a First Amendment right. Well, I'll tell you exactly what's happening. As a result of that decision, corporations are spending millions and millions of dollars on the political process, and they do not even need to disclose who they are. So they're doing this secretly. They're setting up phony organizations. There was a piece in the Washington Post on Saturday. Peter DeFazio from Oregon is one of the most progressive members of the House of Representatives. And he suddenly noticed that a lot of money was coming in by some phony group that no one had ever heard of, political ads attacking him, supporting his opponent. He tried to find out who was putting the money in. He went to the address, knocked on the door. He can't find it out because by law, this phony group does not have to disclose who their contributors are. We do know that some billionaire families are now pouring huge sums of money into the political process. And they're doing it in a way that we just don't know who they are and who they're funding. So we have a terrible, in terms of campaign finance in this country, we have had for many years a terrible situation, and that situation has been made much, much worse by Citizens United. We brought a vote up on the floor of the Senate last week in order just to get disclosure, just to say, for example, that we think it's wrong. We should prevent foreign corporations. Some of these corporations are contributing money into the political process. They could be foreign corporations. We try to deal with that. We try to have the CEOs of the corporations be on television saying, be part of the ad saying, I approve this message. Couldn't do that. So the Republicans know that they have a very good thing. Their friends on the Supreme Court voted for that. They have taken advantage of it, and it makes a terrible situation even worse.
Our guest is U.S. Senator Bernie Sanders, who you've just been listening to. I'm Bob McChesney. This is Media Matters and WILL AM 580. We welcome your calls at 333-9455 or toll-free 1-800-222-9455. This coming week, Senator Sanders, the new Bob Woodward book is coming out. It's already getting a lot of talk in the Washington political community. And it's about the Obama administration's stance towards the war in Afghanistan and its relationship with the military. And according to the White House, it's a fairly accurate picture, at least according to the press secretary Gibbs. And, you know, I wonder what your take is. And let me give you my a line I think of a lot. It's come up in my research and my teaching recently, which was President James Madison commenting that no nation that remains permanently at war abroad can remain free at home. And, you know, we're in these wars now that seem almost endless in Asia. I mean, they're lasting generations. I have students in college now who don't remember when we weren't at war. And, you know, they don't look like they're ever going to end. What is your take on these wars, and what ought we be doing, and what ought the Obama administration do?
Well, I agree with that sentiment that you have expressed. And, you know, right now, this hits me a little bit hard, because just yesterday we learned from the Department of Defense that another young man, a 20-year-old from northern Vermont, was killed in Afghanistan. A couple of months ago, we had another young man killed in terms of the war in Iraq. My state, probably per capita, lost more soldiers than any other state in the country. So this is an issue that weighs on me. I would say two things. Number one, international terrorism is a serious issue. There's no question there are people out there who want to do our nation harm, who think that they're going to go to heaven if they blow up, you know, airplanes and so forth and so on. And we have to be vigilant, and we have to figure out a way to fight international terrorism along with other countries around the world in an intelligent way. If you're asking me, do I think continuing to have the large number of soldiers in Afghanistan that we currently do year after year after year, and having that war in Iraq, you know, continuing, it has certainly been downsized in terms of American soldiers, but it's still there. Has that been good policy? No, it has not been. So I think, and the point that you make, we are spending as a nation at a time when our infrastructure is collapsing, when we are now 12th in the world in terms of the number of our kids who go to college, in terms of the fact that we remain dependent on energy from Saudi Arabia and other foreign countries, in terms of having some 50 million Americans who today have no health insurance, and on and on and on, with all of the enormous problems facing our country, do I think we can afford to continue to spend $700 billion every single year on the military, when I think all of us know that a lot of that money is based on the old Cold War with the Soviet Union? So the issue is, it's not only freedom, but it's also economic vitality. We are falling behind many other countries. I think we have to invest in health care, in education, in reversing global warming, in transforming our energy system, and having the kind of rail system and public transportation that we need, et cetera, et cetera. We need enormous investments in America. We need to create jobs in America. So giving tax breaks to billionaires and spending $700 billion a year on the military, frankly, does not make a whole lot of sense to me. So to answer your question, Bob, yeah, I think we have got to rethink Afghanistan. Nobody wants to see the Taliban regain power. On the other hand, supporting a corrupt administration does not do us a whole lot of good. So it's tougher than it looks, but I think we have to rethink what we're doing.
Our guest, U.S. Senator Bernie Sanders. Let's go to the phone lines now for several callers who have been waiting patiently. We'll start with line one, Champaign County. Welcome to Media Matters. You're on there with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Thanks very much. I wanted to ask you, I heard a very intensely critical analysis of this $50 billion infrastructure bank and the latest sort of attempt to look like in the New Deal. The argument is that this is actually a part of the whole capture of the government by the finance, because it really, it isn't new money. It isn't something that's it's really going to be captured by the finance capital, and it won't really do that much. And this is in the context of the Civil Engineering Trade Association, whatever professional organization.
The American Society of Civil Engineers.
Right, $1 trillion in the next 10 years, and I'm gasping here, so I'll have to hang up. But in the context of the Republicans having a conference, almost having to move their convention because of a bridge collapse. On the day that still a supposedly legitimate prospect eventually for presidential candidacy, I forget his name now, in Minnesota, the governor at the time.
Paul Lente.
How is it possible to to not be able to make an argument that we need to put people into work. The argument earlier about automation, surely, but while our son...
I got your point.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, caller. And Bernie Sanders, I know this is an issue near and dear to your heart, so tee off.
The caller is absolutely right. What the American Society of Civil Engineers says, they give our infrastructure a grade. The grade is D, D. They suggest, and these people are, you know, kind of nonpartisan nerd type wonks, you know, policy wonks, you know, this is the American Society of Civil Engineers. They estimate that we need to invest $2.2 trillion in our infrastructure in the next 5 years. Now, let me just tell you what goes on in my state, and I think there are states where it's worse. There are states where the situation may be better. In my state, we have a huge number of bridges that absolutely have to be repaired. Some of them are no longer usable. We have antiquated water systems that need to be repaired. We have wastewater systems that need to be rebuilt. We have a rail system, not only in Vermont, but all over this country, which has fallen apart. We got trains that go 25, 30 miles an hour compared to Europe and Japan, where trains are going hundreds of miles an hour, the only major country that doesn't have high-speed rail. So I think in terms of bridges and roads and water systems and schools and culverts, the need out there is enormous. Our airports are behind airports around the world. The kind of system control that our air controllers use is antiquated. So the caller is absolutely right. $50 billion a year doesn't do anywhere near enough. And the importance of investing right now is that infrastructure investment creates a heck of a lot of jobs. Economists estimate it's about $45,000 jobs for every $1 billion we invest. So in the middle of a deep recession, when we have trillions of dollars of unmet infrastructure needs, which will make our nation stronger and more competitive, now is the time to invest. Now, you asked, well, what could the caller asked, what could be the argument against it? Well, the argument against it is Republicans believe that government should play a minimal role in our lives. When they argue against Social Security, they don't argue against the fact that Social Security has worked very, very well, done exactly what it is supposed to be doing. They don't want the government to be involved in helping seniors with a dignified retirement, helping the disabled, helping widows and orphans. It is a philosophical issue. They want the private sector to do that. In terms of infrastructure, nobody I know believes that the private sector is going to do it. It has to be a role of cities, towns, and the federal government. So I agree with the caller very much. I think we should make significant investments in our infrastructure, improve our competitiveness around the world, become more productive, and create jobs right now when we desperately need them.
It's going to just a purely political page outside of the economic argument, the moral argument. But it strikes me that had the Democrats and had the Obama administration just really put all their chips on the infrastructure number in 2009, and that today we were going around the country and seeing, you know, hundreds of thousands of workers actually building rail lines and bridges and schools and hospitals and all the things that are collapsing this country, that the morale of this country would be very different than it is.
That is absolutely, in my view, correct. But I want to tell you something else which is very problematic, and this gets back to an issue that, you know, you have done a brilliant job on over the years, and that is media and what people know. For example, right now in my state, again, I'm using my state as an example, we have the potential to make a very significant investment as a result of the stimulus package in broadband, which is a huge issue in rural America. We have some 20% of the people in the state of Vermont who do not have access to broadband, which is absolutely incredible in the year 2010. We are making progress in that area. We're making progress in the railroad. We're making progress in rebuilding bridges and roads. A lot of people don't see it. They don't know it. And that has a lot to do with media, I think. You have many people who just do not know the role that government is playing and has played. And they say, I don't see it. I don't see it. There are states, for example, around America where there are no signs talking about the stimulus package paying for the investments and the improvements that people are seeing. So the question is, A, making the investment and making sure that people understand the role that these investments are playing in transforming their community and in creating jobs.
Let's go back to the phone lines. Our guest today on Media Matters, you've just been listening to, is U.S. Senator Bernie Sanders from Vermont. Let's now go to line two. Urbana, you're on the air.
Senator Sanders, it's a real privilege. I remember the Vermont Liberty Union Party back in the old days, and Ben Spock's campaign for president in 72 and 76. This is Jim from Labor's World View, Urbana Public Television. We're on today at 4 o'clock on Comcast Channel 6 for our locals. We're taking up the question of the banks today. And since the last time the Sherman Antitrust Act was used was by President Carter, I believe, against the Bell Telephone Company. Now, why is that not applicable, or what are the impediments of keeping it from applicable to use against the banksters today and Wall Street? And furthermore, one last point on that is that we have seen a revolving door between the White House, Goldman Sachs, and a few other banks, the World Bank, and the International Monetary Fund charge against Europe and basically bring down the government of Greece by attacking one of its institutions. And I'll ring off and let you answer that, and thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much, caller.
Jim has asked a whole lot of very good questions. In terms of Liberty Union, that was a third party that I used to be involved in. I'm an independent and longer-serving independent in congressional history. Before that, I was a member of a third party in the state of Rhode Island called the Liberty Union. Jim asked some good questions in terms of antitrust and banks. I agree with him. Most people don't understand this. But right now, if you look at the four largest financial institutions in America, which are Bank of America, Citigroup, Wells Fargo, and J.P. Morgan Chase, Bob, if you look at their assets collectively, you add them all up, these four financial institutions own more than half of the GDP of the United States of America, more than $7 trillion combined. These four institutions issue two-thirds of the credit cards and half the mortgages in America. And Jim, I think, is asking, why do we allow that concentration of ownership in the among financial institutions? And I think he's right. I introduced legislation that would break these financial institutions up. We had a more modest bill come to the floor of the Senate that begins the process. I think we got 32 or 33 votes for that. So it's an example of where the Wall Street folks have tremendous power and concentration of ownership is way out of hand. And Jim is absolutely right. We do need to break them up through antitrust activities.
Bernie, before you go on, can I just ask you to follow up on that? From your experience in the Senate, I hear politicians from both parties, but especially the Republican Party, talk about their love of competition and free markets and free enterprise. Are any of them share your concern with monopoly and hyper-concentrated markets that prevent competition or working to the public's benefit? Is John Boehner talking to you about ways possibly to enforce antitrust, for example?
We didn't get one Republican vote on that issue. And again, the hypocrisy is really rampant. Republicans often talk about their desire to cut back on big government, and they hate the federal government. Everything should be done in the states. And yet sometimes in terms of financial matters, when we want states to be able to have the freedom to go forward faster and stronger, for example, say in consumer protection, than the federal government would allow us, they side with the big banks and have mandates that prevent local government from going forward. So the hypocrisy is extraordinary. You would think, and your point is well taken, that somebody who believes in localism, in small government, in small business, would be appalled by four financial institutions having assets worth more than half the GDP in this country, and yet we couldn't get one Republican vote and even modest efforts to stop breaking them up. So in terms of Jim also asks about the revolving door, and I think he's suggesting that the Obama administration has been not as aggressive in taking on Wall Street that many of the people around them, whether it is Geithner, Bernanke, Jack Lew, who has just been nominated to be new OMB director, Larry Summers, are too cozy with Wall Street. I share that concern, and I have voted against some of those nominees for that reason. I, on the other hand, am delighted that the President of the United States appointed Elizabeth Warren to be the architect of the new consumer protection agency created in the financial reform bill. I got to tell you, some of us worked very, very hard doing our best to make sure the president would appoint her, and I'm delighted that he did. Elizabeth Warren is precisely the kind of person that we need around the president, a person who understands the needs of the middle class and working class of this country and has shown through her career, both in the private sector and in government, a willingness to stand up to big money interests when that's necessary.
Senator Bernie Sanders, we have a caller waiting patiently, but I wanted to just ask one point on what your comment you're just making about Elizabeth Warren. There's, I think, a lot of people who follow politics closely are still unclear what to make of President Barack Obama. I know your desk was right next to his when he was in the U.S. Senate, and you got to know him a bit and speak with him. And what can you tell us about him that maybe isn't coming through in the newscast?
Well, just a couple of things. Number one, he is an extraordinarily smart person. He is very, very intelligent, and obviously based on the campaign that he ran, which I thought in 2008 was perhaps the best national campaign that I've seen in my lifetime, this guy knows how to reach out to people, knows how to inspire people, knows how to bring people together. And those are all very important strengths. I would say that the weakness that he has is not grasping that there are folks out there who do not like him, who are not sympathetic to a progressive point of view, and that instead of reaching out to them, trying to work with them, to finally understand that that strategy hasn't worked. For example, the idea of appointing an Alan Simpson to be the co-chair of a deficit reduction commission is absurd. Simpson does not like Social Security, does not like Medicare. You just shouldn't be doing that. The idea of reaching out early on, asking somebody like Senator Judd Gregg of New Hampshire to be his Secretary of Commerce, who later rejected that position, absurd. So I think what the president is not getting, and what worries me very much, that at the end of the day, the big money interests are never going to like him. They're never going to respect him. They will continue to try to undermine everything he does. And he's got to get that through his head. And he's got to reach out to working class people, to progressives, to those people who want real change, to those people who are prepared to stand with him against the right-wing Republicans who have so much ascendancy right now and against the big money interest. I think that's a lesson, for whatever reason, he has not yet understood.
Well, we'll see what lesson he takes after the election results come in early November. Our guest, U.S. Senator Bernie Sanders, we have one last caller who's been waiting very patiently. I hope they are still with us. Line 3, Champagne, you're on the air.
Hi. Wow. It's amazing. It's, everything makes so much sense that I'm surprised that there aren't that many people going with you on that. I have a question on it as far as the Republicans having to say that they want to stop all the spending that the Democrats are doing, and then still create jobs. And what I'm finding very confusing is how they haven't had a plan on how they're going to do that. Is there anything that you can enlighten us on?
Sure.
What's going on?
That's an excellent, that's a very good question, because, it exposes the hypocrisy of the Republicans. For a start, they bemoan, and every day they are so concerned about spending. Well, how did we get to a $13 trillion debt? You got it because they voted for, along with some Democrats, the war in Iraq, which many of us opposed, which will end up costing some $3 trillion by the time the last veteran is taken care of, unpaid for. They gave huge amounts of tax breaks to the very wealthiest people in this country, unpaid for. They passed a Medicare Part D prescription drug program in which they did not allow the Medicare to negotiate prices with the pharmaceutical industry, unpaid for, that entire program. They bailed out, with Bush's leadership, Wall Street, unpaid for. So to argue that they're now concerned about government spending when they owe up their policies and their votes led us to where we are today is just outrageous hypocrisy. Number two, they talk about the need to create jobs. What is their strategy? And the answer is same old, same old. Tax breaks for the rich. Well, we saw that movie for 8 years under Bush. It was a grotesque failure. We lost 600,000 jobs. Their other strategy, brilliant strategy, is more deregulation. Get the government out of businesses' lives. Well, we saw that movie as well. That's what Wall Street collapse was about. We deregulated. We let Wall Street do whatever they want. We let BP do whatever they want. Very weak regulation over offshore drilling. We saw what deregulation does in terms of protecting consumers in unsafe food practices. We saw that movie also. It was a failure. So then the third part of their program is more unfettered free trade. Well, I think you talk to the average worker in America who may have seen his or her job go to China or India or Mexico. They know about that policy as well. So to answer the caller's questions, number one, absolute hypocrisy for the Republicans, who under Bush drove up the national debt by almost twice as much. Let's not forget, Clinton gave them a significant surplus. They drove up the deficit, the national debt, by almost a double. Number two, more unfettered free trade so we can lose more good-paying manufacturing and white-collar jobs. And number three, more deregulation so corporate America can continue to rip off the American people. That is a recipe for failure. We went through that. It is imperative that we don't go through that again. And that's about all that our Republican friends have to say when you get through the rhetoric.
We've only got less than a minute left, and I have another caller who's been trying to get on with you, Senator Sanders. So let's go to Line 4 Chicago. And Line 4 Chicago, if I can ask you to be as brief as possible.
All right. Regarding the matter of too big to fail, derivatives have grown to more than $900 trillion. And if and when it should fall, it can bring down the whole world economic system. Also, the Bank for International Settlement is intending to establish international currency, and our former Secretary of Paulson is now working for them.
He was pushing.
Who would control the currency, controls everything and anything. Could you comment on this, please?
Well, very briefly. Your point is, you know, without going into great detail, the fact of the matter is three out of the four largest financial institutions in this country today are larger than they were before the financial collapse. So too big to fail remains an enormous issue with the kind of concentration of ownership we see in financial institutions. In my view, as I said a few moments ago, we've got to break these banks up and bring competition to the marketplace there, not allow this incredible concentration of ownership to continue.
Senator Sanders, I hear the band tuning up in the background. That means they want to clear me out of the studio. I want to thank you from the bottom of my heart for taking time from your schedule to join us today at Media Matters.
Well, thank you very much, Bob, and you keep up the great work that you've been doing on all of these media issues.
Much appreciated. And I want to thank Kyle Kroha, my engineer, for working the board today, and of course, Melissa Trentz, the producer, for all her great work that she always does. Everyone, we'll be back in 167 hours. We'll be with Lewis Hyde talking about copyright intellectual property and how better to understand it. It should be a great show. Until then, have a great week.